find that the President-elect of the United States has proceeded slowly down that ramp, dignifiedly before the eyes of 100,000 admiring spectators, to the flourishes and the ruffles of the United States Marine Band and to the music of the Hail to the Chief. For the nation's new executive will shortly become the honorary Commander-in-Chief of the United States Marine Band, the President's own. And there he is directly before the lectern with Mark Seiss, who is the new sergeant at arms of the Senate, or I suppose he is, I'm not positive of my point. And now for Mr. Hill.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the serene moment of this greatest pageant of America. Within a very few moments, the Chief Justice of the United States will deliver the oath of office to Franklin D. Roosevelt. As I look out,
there it is.
There are at least 150,000 faces upturned. Not the sound, utmost silence, the grand suspense and expectancy.
You, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you solemnly swear that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of your ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help you God.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Hoover, Mr. Chief Justice, my friend, this is a day of national consecration, and I am certain that on this day my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory. And I am convinced that you will again give that support to leadership in these critical days. In such a spirit on my part and on yours, we face our common difficulties. They concern, thank God, only material things. Values have shrunk to fantastic levels, taxes have risen, our ability to pay has fallen, government of all kinds is faced by serious curtailment of income, the means of exchange are frozen in the currents of trade, the withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side, farmers find no market for their produce, and the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. More important, a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment. And yet our distress comes from no failure of substance. We are stricken by no plague of locusts. Compared with the perils which our forefathers conquered because they believed and were not afraid, we have still much to be thankful for. Nature still offers her bounty, and human efforts have multiplied it. Plenty is at our doorstep, but a generous use of it languishes in the very sight of the supply. Primarily, this is because the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and have abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. True, they have tried, but their efforts have been cast in the pattern of an outworn tradition. Faced by failure of credit, they have proposed only the lending of more money. Stripped of the lure of profit by which to induce our people to follow their false leadership, they have resorted to exhortation, pleading carefully for restored confidence. They only know the rules of a generation of self-seekers. They have no vision, and when there is no vision, the people perish. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truth. The measure of that restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values, more noble than mere monetary profit. Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort, the joy, the moral stimulation of work. No longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent profit. These dark days, my friends, will be worth all they cost us if they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves, to our fellow men. Recognition of that falsity of material wealth as the standard of success goes hand in hand with the abandonment of the false belief that public office and high political position are to be valued only by the standard of pride of place and personal profit. And there must be an end to a conduct in banking and in business which too often has given to a sacred trust the likeness of callous and selfish wrongdoing. Small wonder that confidence languishes, for it thrives only on honesty, on honor, on the sacredness of obligation, on faithful protection, and on unselfish performance. Without them, it cannot live. Restoration calls, however, not for changes in ethics alone. This nation is asking for action, and action now. Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources. Hand in hand with that, we must frankly recognize the overbalance of population in our industrial centers. And by engaging on a national scale in a redistribution endeavor to provide a better use of the land for those best fitted for the land. Yes, the task can be helped by definite efforts to raise the values of agricultural products and with this the power to purchase the output of our cities. It can be helped by preventing realistically the tragedy of the growing loss through foreclosure of our small homes and our farms. It can be helped by insistence that the federal, the state, and the local governments act forthwith on the demand that their costs be drastically reduced. It can be helped by the unifying of relief activities which today are often scattered, uneconomical, unequal. It can be helped by national planning for and supervision of all forms of transportation and of communications and other utilities that have a definitely public character. There are many ways in which it can be helped, but it can never be helped by merely talking about it. We must act. We must act quickly. And finally, in our progress towards a resumption of work, we require two safeguards against a return of the evils of the old order. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credits and investments. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency. These, my friends, are the lines of attack I shall presently urge upon a new Congress in special session, detailed measures for their fulfillment, and I shall seek the immediate assistance of the 48 states. Through this program of action, we address ourselves to putting our own national house in order and making income balance outgo. Our international trade relations, though vastly important, are in point of time and necessity secondary to the establishment of a sound national economy. I favor, as a practical policy, the putting of first things first. I shall spare no effort to restore world trade by international economic readjustment, but the emergency at home cannot wait on that accomplishment. The basic thought that guides these specific means of national recovery is not narrowly nationalistic. It is the insistence, as a first consideration, upon the interdependence of the various elements in and parts of the United States of America, a recognition of the old and permanently important manifestation of the American spirit of the pioneer. It is the way to recovery. It is the immediate way. It is the strongest assurance that recovery will endure. In the field of world policy, I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor. The neighbor who resolutely respects himself and, because he does so, respects the rights of others. The neighbor who respects his obligations and respects the sanctity of his agreements in and with a world of neighbors. If I read the temper of our people correctly, we now realize, as we have never realized before, our interdependence on each other, that we cannot merely take, but we must give as well. That if we are to go forward, we must move as a trained and loyal army, willing to sacrifice for the good of a common discipline. Because without such discipline, no progress can be made, no leadership becomes effective. We are, I know, ready and willing to submit our lives and our property to such discipline because it makes possible a leadership which aims at the larger good. This I propose to offer, pledging that the larger purposes will bind upon us all as a sacred obligation, with a unity of duty hitherto evoked only in times of armed strife. With this pledge taken, I assume unhesitatingly the leadership of this great army of our people dedicated to a disciplined attack upon our common problem. Action in this image, action to this end, is feasible under the form of government which we have inherited from our ancestors. Our Constitution is so simple, so practical, that it is possible always to meet extraordinary needs by changes in emphasis and arrangement without loss of essential form. That is why our constitutional system has proved itself the most superbly enduring political mechanism the modern world has ever seen. It has met every stress of vast expansion of territory, of foreign wars, of bitter internal strife, of world relations. And it is to be hoped that the normal balance of executive and legislative authority may be wholly equal, wholly adequate to meet the unprecedented task before us. But it may be that an unprecedented demand and need for undelayed action may call for temporary departure from that normal balance of public procedure. I am prepared, under my constitutional duty, to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. These measures, or such other measures as the Congress may build out of its experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring to speedy adoption. But in the event that the Congress shall fail to take one of these two courses, in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis: broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe. For the trust reposed in me, I will return the courage and the devotion that befits the time. I can do no less. We face the arduous days that lie before us in the warm courage of national unity, with the clear consciousness of seeking old and precious moral values. We face the arduous days that lie before us in the warm courage of national unity, with the clear consciousness of seeking old and precious moral values, with the clean satisfaction that comes from the stern performance of duty by old and young alike, we aim at the assurance of a rounded, a permanent national life. We do not distrust the future of essential democracy. The people of the United States have not failed. In their need, they have registered a mandate that they want direct, vigorous action. They have asked for discipline and direction under leadership. They have made me the present instrument of their wishes. in the spirit of the gift, I take it. In this dedication of a nation, we humbly ask the blessing of God. May He protect each and every one of us. May He guide me in the days to come.
Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Charles Evan Hughes, who made a spectacular figure as he administered the oath prior to the reading of the inaugural address. Mr. Herbert Clark Hoover, former President of the United States, congratulated Mr. Roosevelt on his ascendancy to the presidency by grasping him firmly by the hands, as did many of the officials on the platform. And smilingly, Mr. Roosevelt acknowledged all these courtesies and all these feelings of appreciation and thankfulness. That large crowd outside war whooped it for a moment and then started running for the fringes of the parking, running through the woods and over the greensward, and incidentally waving handkerchiefs in appreciation for the new president and in reverence and in love for him. Mrs. Hoover and Mr. Hoover are now leaving toward the right, which is the south of South Capitol Street. And as they disappear, they will take their four cars and now return to private life. A terrific roar of applause from those on the official platform has been given to Mr. Hoover and Mrs. Hoover as they disappear from view. Still on the presidential platform, smiling as he has never smiled before, and surrounded by his sons and his personal bodyguards and his secretaries, Mr. Roosevelt is accepting more of the cordialities. At the present moment, former Vice President Charles Curtis has just grasped his hand, and now the official party makes its way, ladies and gentlemen, from the inaugural platform, slowly down the ramp, which leads further off the inaugural platform to the flanking wings to the right and left, preceded by the military and naval aides, while the Marine Band is playing the Hail to the Chief in the background and underneath our voice. As he proceeds, Mr. Roosevelt, resting on the arms of one of his sons, acknowledges the uproarious applause, voluminous in its density and intensity, and keeps smiling to the crowds. He disappears suddenly for a moment behind an audience rushing to the platform, and the official party follows. Remember, Mr. and Mrs. Hoover have gone out one entrance and are disappearing into private life, and all eyes are now on the President of the United States. Mr. Roosevelt is disappearing from view, ladies and gentlemen, and from the northeast portico of the east front of the Capitol, Mr. William Slater is ready to describe for you the departure of the President of the United States. Mr. Slater.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a new radio viewpoint up here.
The target radio comes in behind the President Roosevelt party carrying a little girl, probably one of the little Roosevelt relatives who was enjoying this occasion just tremendously. This is a very fine, beautiful scene just before us here. Mr. Roosevelt is smiling ever more broadly all the time. He's nearing his cars now. The cars have drawn up down at the foot of the ramp. It's a beautiful long white ramp with dark red plush down the center of it. We see Mr. John Garner coming along in the presidential party there, surrounded by his friends, talking to them. Mr. Roosevelt is getting closer and closer to the car that will bear him back to the White House. He's acknowledging the plaudits of the crowd in his characteristic way. He's a splendid-looking figure, a president of whom we can all be proud. Proud, oh, just so proud. He's very close to his car now. Everyone has removed their hat, his hat there in the vicinity. Mr. Roosevelt is at his car now. He's stepping into the back part of the car. Secret Service men are helping him in there. The motors have all been started. The Secret Service cars are completely surrounding the presidential car by this time. Mr. Roosevelt has taken his seat in the back of this long, black, open touring car here. He's still acknowledging the applause of the crowd. They're putting an overcoat on him now. He's putting on a long, black top coat there, which he will need in the stiff afternoon breeze. And he's drawing that up around him now. One of his sons is helping him, and there's his bodyguards from New York. And now Mrs.
Franklin Roosevelt, the new First Lady of the Land, 1933 American woman up to date, a splendid figure down there, seated beside her husband in the presidential car, and they're going to commence the march back through the White House again, where both of them will live for the next 4 years. Mrs. Roosevelt is carrying a beautiful bouquet of dark violets down there. It matches her costume very nicely, and she presents, too, a striking figure on this memorable occasion here in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital. The big robe is being draped now over the knees of Mr. and Mrs. Roosevelt down there, and other members of the party have gotten into the car. Now the chauffeur has climbed in front. They're closing the doors, and the presidential car is about to move off. As it does so, the crowd throngs in here more and more intensely all the time, and now the United States Army Cavalry Escort is swinging into action up in advance of the car. There goes the puff of the motor. The car is moving out. The Secret Service cars close in around it, and it's being whisked away under the archway of the Senate wing of the Capitol, and there are the tremendous cheers of the throng as Mr. Roosevelt commences his triumphal ride back to the White House as a permanent resident. On both sides of the car, Secret Service men are on the running board, and the Secret Service cars are pressing in closely. It's a fine, orderly crowd, however, and the procession is forming over there. The cavalry is forming up in front. There come the motorcycle cars swinging into line with whining sirens on them. They move out through the crowd now, and you can undoubtedly hear the delirium, the joy, and the exultation that accompanies Mr. Roosevelt's departure from the Capitol, where he has been inaugurated as President of the United States. The crowd closes in on Mr. Roosevelt, and they're giving him considerable of an ovation as he moves out. One significant thing has appealed to us as we have stood high above the inaugural ceremonies here and have observed everything which has taken place in connection with the induction of President Roosevelt into office. And that is that the crowd, although it has been enthusiastic and it has lent its applause generously, it has not been so enthusiastic or so generous in its applause as to suggest just mere partisan delirium or thoughtlessness. It has been a sober thinking crowd, and to my mind, as Mr. Roosevelt moves away from the Capitol now toward the White House, the crowd is turning to Mr. Roosevelt, a veritable mass of humanity with upturned faces in this direction, looking toward this one man, as if to say, Franklin Roosevelt, make good.